Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
He's probably right, but Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner did sound just a little bit hopeful this morning when he was out talking about the debt limit.
Congress is going to pass an increase in the debt ceiling. They recognize that. They know they have to do that. They've always done that.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on mileage and safe driving habits. Learn more at progressive.com. Marketplace Innovation Reporting is supported by the 2011 Jaguar XJ. Learn more at a local dealer or at jaguarusa.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, today the 19th of April. Good to have you with us. Timothy Geithner was out making the rounds on business television this morning, talking more to the markets than anybody else, really. Geithner's doing all he can to minimize the debt-related blowback from Standard & Poor's yesterday that Washington's on notice for a AAA-rated downgrade. We'll pick up our coverage where our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore left off yesterday.
If the U.S. is downgraded, the government would have to pay more to borrow, which would, of course, increase the deficit even more. In New York...
And that gets us to the bond market, where the government goes to borrow all that money Heidi was talking about. Stocks got clobbered yesterday, as you know, but bonds were fine. Borrowing actually got cheaper for Washington after the S&P news broke. How come? Here's Heidi one more time.
When you think of U.S. Treasury bonds, you don't usually think of beauty queens, but it might help. That's because treasuries, like beauty queens, often look best when compared to who's standing next to them. Right now, treasuries are standing next to debt from Greece and other troubled European countries. So they look pretty good even after the bomb S&P dropped on Monday. Here's Ken Taubes. He's the chief investment officer of Pioneer Investments.
The debt woes in Europe continue to plague markets.
Europe's bonds are hard to sell. The Greek government has to pay 13% interest to borrow money for 10 years. The U.S. pays only around 3%, and there's plenty of demand for Treasury bonds. Guy Labat is a fixed income strategist with Janney Montgomery Scott. He says it takes a lot these days to throw the bond market off.
This is an event that 5 years ago would have been both unexpected and unimaginable. So the fact that the reaction was relatively calm and relatively orderly really speaks to the strength and resilience the financial crisis has bred into the financial markets.
Bond investors tend to think longer term, so they don't overreact at old news like the giant deficit, says Anthony Valeri. He's the chief fixed income strategist for LPL Financial.
Ultimately, economic growth, the level of inflation, and what the Federal Reserve ends up doing when they hike interest rates will have a greater impact than ratings decisions.
So unless the economic outlook sours, treasuries are still winning the pageant. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
The nuclear power story detoured briefly to Chernobyl today. At a meeting in Ukraine marking the 25th anniversary of that disaster, donor nations promised to give another $780 million to help build a new radiation containment shell at the site. Crews at the Fukushima Daiichi plant in Japan have started pumping highly radioactive water out of the basement of one of the damaged reactors. Over the weekend, officials said it could take 9 months to fully shut things down. But once that problem's taken care of, Japan's going to have to deal with another dilemma, as Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
Before the Fukushima disaster, Japan had plans to almost double its nuclear capacity. That meant a full half of the country's electricity would come from nuclear power someday. It was all part of a national plan to cut global warming emissions. But that vision is now in doubt. James Lucier is with the research firm Capital Alpha.
I suspect that the credibility factor, the deep damage to the Tokyo Electric Power Company's credibility in particular, is going to forestall any serious decisions about building nuclear power plants for quite some time.
Lu Lucier says in the short and medium term, the country has no choice but to rely on energy sources that spew greenhouse gases. He says that primarily means importing liquid natural gas and gas turbines.
Given the immense reconstruction effort underway in northern Japan, they don't have time. They don't have resources to build other types of power plants.
Natural gas plants can be built quickly, and General Electric and Siemens are already offering to supply the equipment. But if Japan ever phased out its nuclear reactors completely, an analysis in Forbes calculates the country's carbon footprint would grow 10% over current levels. One carbon analyst says it's not clear if Japan's overall emissions have shot up since the earthquake. One factor limiting those emissions, she says, is a fall in economic activity, along with demand for electricity. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, no fall. It was a rise. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here's the thing about technology companies. One day, they're startups. The next day, they're startups worth billions of dollars. Just 5 years ago, Twitter was basically unknown. Now it's almost too well known. Investors are clamoring for a slice of its still private shares. And that, in turn, is giving Twitter a very grown-up corporate problem. It has to actually make some money. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Twitter started to get serious about bringing in revenue a year ago. It made its first foray into the world of advertising and began selling promoted tweets.
They're definitely seeing real revenue from their advertising.
Deborah Williamson is at eMarketer. She's done what's considered the most thorough analysis of Twitter's revenue. Williams says Twitter probably sold $45 million in ads last year. This year, she expects that number to triple. But Andrew Lipsman at Comscore says Twitter's explosive growth may be history.
The audience is growing more steadily. It's certainly not accelerating as quickly as it did before.
One problem for Twitter is lots of folks access it through third-party apps, like TweetDeck, which brings together your tweets and Facebook messages all in one place. Apps like this stand between Twitter and some users. And Williamson says Twitter's ads may not reach those people.
And that's a big problem. I mean, if a large group of your loyal, dedicated users are using a platform where they're not seeing your advertising, I mean, that's a big opportunity for Twitter.
For months, Twitter's been pushing to connect more directly with its entire audience. But some apps, like TweetDeck, are so popular, Twitter can't simply push them aside. Instead, it may buy them. There are reports today Twitter could spend as much as $50 million on the TweetDeck app. Twitter's execs declined to comment. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Back to my point about startups. For a second here. No matter how big they wind up eventually getting, there's always a moment in a company where it's just a couple of people with an idea trying to make a go of it. 35 years ago, it was Paul Allen and Bill Gates with an idea that eventually became Microsoft. Paul Allen's got a new memoir out about the early days in that company and what he's been doing since he left. It's called Idea Man. Paul Allen, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
You know, much has been made of the, tempestuous relationship between yourself and Bill Gates. But bear with me while I ask you this question. You know, there you guys are. You're running a company that would eventually be a multi-billion dollar business. And granted, it was the early days. But which one was more difficult to manage, the company and its development or your relationship with Bill Gates?
Wow, that's an interesting question. No, I think Bill and I had a very, very productive working relationship, and we could finish each other's sentences. We were shoulder to shoulder doing that first version of BASIC and some things that came after that. So we were a really productive partnership and team. As the company grows, you start to become more specialized, and I was always more focused on the technology side, where technology was going, and Bill was more drawn to the business side. So we kind of bifurcated our interest.
Did you ever disagree, though, on where to take the company?
Oh, there were continual heated interchanges and disagreements, but we were able to work through those. And I think at one point in the book, I talk about how just hiring people, he would talk to Steve Ballmer, who's the current CEO of Microsoft, about hiring people. And I had the office next to Bill, so I could hear these discussions at super high volume about Bill's skepticism that we should hire a bunch more people and Steve's insistence that if the company was going to grow and deliver on all the promises made, it had to hire a lot more people. So my personal approach is a little different. I think you can usually examine these things at a lower level of intensity.
So what happened to Microsoft? I mean, here we've got Google and Apple and all these whiz-bang technology companies, and they are what you guys used to be.
Right. In the book, I call them the hellhounds that are either chasing Microsoft or in some cases ahead of Microsoft. There's a real danger when you become big and successful that you miss opportunities. Early on, we were hyper-vigilant about looking at potential competition or areas we might have missed. But as you get big, you get slower, you can become less able to react to all these changes. And I think, unfortunately, some of that's happened, and Microsoft's doing its best to try to catch up and get back to be in a leadership position in some of these areas. But that's really hard to do.
You actually talk a little bit about what you perceive as a culture of mediocrity now at Microsoft. And you quote a guy who's a senior manager there saying, yeah, I'd like to take every fourth person at this company and just take them out and shoot them, and we'd be much better off.
Well, he was speaking metaphorically.
Well, yeah, of course. But right? I mean, the point is made.
Right. No, I think that you have to be very vigilant and diligent in trying to keep up the standard of employees. I mean, there's a lot of great people at Microsoft, but you've got 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people working on some of their big systems over there. It's just much, much harder to maintain the same standard.
You got sick in the early 1980s with Hodgkin's lymphoma. That is one of, if not the main thing that led you to leave Microsoft in 1983. Do you think the company would be different had you stayed?
I'd like to think so. I mean, it's unknowable, obviously. But, you know, I always came up with new ideas. The company did fantastically well after I left with some of the things we just started to do, obviously Windows and Word and Excel and many of those products. But I like to think that my ideas could have helped.
Do they pick up the phone when you call?
Oh, yeah. You have to imagine the challenges that they're under facing all the competition they are. But I think, you know, when you've got groups at companies that are invested in their strategies, it's very hard for them to make dramatic changes in those strategies.
You've had a number of health scares in recent years, and you said that Bill Gates was the guy who came to visit you the most in the hospital. And I'm wondering a final thought about your relationship with him. I mean, you've said you'll never have a business partner again the way you had a partnership with Bill Gates.
No, Bill, the partnership with Bill was a completely unique and fortuitous thing for both of us. And you can probably tick off on the fingers of maybe one hand those kinds of business partnerships where each person brings something unique to the game, and yet, you know, it's so complementary and so creative.
Paul Allen, he co-founded Microsoft. He's done a whole bunch of other stuff since then. He's got a new book out. It's called Idea Man. Mr. Allen, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
There is more of my interview with Paul Allen on our website, and he'll be on the Marketplace Tech Report tomorrow. It'll all eventually be on our book blog. That's marketplace.org/thebigbook. Coming up,
the $140 per barrel oil price of 3 years ago was not an aberration. It was a warning.
When politics get in the way of pumping. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rebounded 65 points today, about a 0.5%, closed at 12,266. The NASDAQ rose 9 points, about a 3%, finished at 2,744. The S&P 500 gained 7 points. That's nearly 0.6%, ended things at 1,312. Investors looked past a ballooning budget deficit and focused on corporate earnings instead. Johnson & Johnson beat Wall Street's expectations and then beat the market, rising 3.2% today. Oil hit about $108 a barrel. That pushed up energy stocks. On the eve of the anniversary of its Gulf spill, BP's U.S. shares rose 0.5%. Pricey oil, though, just one downer for the auto industry. General Motors deflated 1.25% today amid reports that the U.S. government might sell its remaining shares at a loss to taxpayers. Bond prices rose slightly. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.36%. That's borrowing getting cheaper for the government again, by the way. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Thomson Reuters, committed to empowering professionals of the world with the knowledge needed to do what they do best, the knowledge effect. And by MassMutual, a mutual life insurance company owned by its members and policyholders. Learn more at MassMutual.com/mutuality. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. President Obama is on the road. He'll hold a town hall at Facebook headquarters in Palo Alto, California to discuss the economy. RSVP at facebook.com/White House. A look at some of the latest numbers in the housing market. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for March. And it's the 12-year anniversary of the Columbine High School massacre, which sparked debate in this country over gun control. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's time for a little bit of Freakonomics Radio, that moment every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is The Hidden Side of Everything. Dubner, welcome back.
Thanks, Kai. You know, I've got a burning question. I was wondering.
All right.
What kind of car do you drive?
Okay, one, why? But two, I have four kids, man. So I drive a minivan.
And what do you think that minivan says about you, Kai Rizdahl, the man?
Oh, it says I'm unbelievably lame. That's what it says. I'm not who I used to be,
well,
is what it says.
I would argue counter to that, right. But let me say this. You know, the fact is that we drive what we drive in some part to tell the world who we are. You know, some people may want to show that they've got a lot of money. Some people want to show that they care a lot about the environment. Or in your case, you know, that you're a good family man.
Now, and proud of it, but go ahead.
A lame family man, that's but right. Proud about it. And now, there are other ways to signal the world who you are, obviously, not just a car. I want you to listen to Tim Harford, who's an economist and author from London.
All right.
The British Prime Minister, David Cameron, when he was leader of the opposition, he's trying to get elected, he wanted to convince people that he was a soft, caring guy, and he installed a little windmill on his house. Now, it turns out wind power can be pretty effective, but you need a really, really big windmill in a really windy location to be efficient.
It sounds a little bit like politics over power generation, right? Because you're not getting a lot of wattage out of that little thing.
Not a lot of wattage, but he did get elected, right?
That is
now,
true. That's true.
Whether the windmill was responsible, it's impossible to say. But if nothing else, Cameron showed off some behavior here that you'd have to call conspicuous. And economists love conspicuous behavior. You go back to Thorsten Veblen a century ago, who coined the phrase conspicuous consumption, which we all know means that you spend money in order to show off your wealth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Cameron, though, was spending money to show off something else. He wanted to show off his environmental bona fides. Now, economists have a name for this, too, which is conspicuous conservation. Here's how a young economics researcher at Berkeley named Steve Sexton describes it.
As sort of a keeping up with the Joneses type concept, but applied to efforts to make society better. I will be competing with my neighbors to donate to a charity, for instance, or to reduce energy conservation or environmental impacts.
We've all seen these people, right? They're the compact fluorescent light bulb folks. They are the bring your own bags into the grocery store. I mean, all stuff trying to save the planet.
That's right. Now, the economist Steve Sexton, I have to say, has a twin sister whose name is Allison, who's also a young economist. Now, these young twin Sexton economists just did a very interesting study where they looked at who buys a hybrid Toyota Prius and why.
Well, all right. So out here, by the way, everybody buys them. And even Toyota says they've just sold their millionth, right?
Yeah, the Prius is the king of the hybrids. Now, yeah. It's not necessarily because it's better than other hybrids. According to the Sextons, it's because the Prius has this unique shape which mm-hmm. screams hybrid, which screams I love the Earth more than you love the Earth. Now, if you live in a community that cares a lot about the environment, somewhere like Boulder, Colorado, that's worth something. Here's Allison Sexton.
The Prius market share increased disproportionately in greener communities relative to other hybrid cars.
So there's your conspicuous conservation effect. And the Sextons estimate that buying a Prius can be worth a few thousand dollars to people in terms of their green self-image and new friends, even better job opportunities, depending on where they live.
Yeah, well, I say this at no risk to my own job opportunity here, Dubner, because many people at Marketplace, well, a couple anyway, have Priuses. But could it be, is what I'm hearing you saying, that driving a Prius is all about making yourself look good rather than actually saving the planet?
Well, it could be. Look, you can't climb inside people's minds, but you can see what they do. And what people do is often a little on the silly side when it comes to conservation, including putting solar panels on the front of your house to show the neighbors, even if that's the shady side of your house. It's not going to generate a lot of power. But people do that. Now, this Friday is Earth Day, Kai, and I'm guessing if you look around, you'll see all kinds of conspicuous conservation happening, which, you know, on the one hand, you could say it's nice that people care. On the other hand, the problem is that can crowd out more worthwhile conservation mm-hmm. ideas, things like, you know, just putting better insulation in your house. But it's hard to show off the insulation to your neighbors. Not very sexy.
Yeah, no, nothing sexy about that. You, on the other hand, well, that's another conversation. Stephen Dubner, our Freakonomics Radio correspondent. Freakonomicsradio.com is the website. Dubner, we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Reputation.com, monitoring, protecting, and improving reputations online while deleting personal data from the Internet. Reputation.com.
We're spending a little bit more time than usual this week talking about oil. Crude's at about $108 a barrel at the moment, worth a conversation or two anytime. But the more lasting oil story dates back a year ago tomorrow, when the Deepwater Horizon exploded and started what has come to be called the BP oil spill. Investigations since then have answered the basic question of why the rig exploded and how the leak happened. But maybe a better question is why BP was drilling in such an inhospitable place to begin with. The answer is part geology, because the easy-to-get-at, easy-to-refine oil is mostly gone. But it's part politics, too, as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports now from the Sustainability Desk.
Once upon a time, big oil companies could go around the world, write checks, and drill on behalf of us, the consumer. That was a long time ago. Today, even though the oil is down there, political fences and stop signs limit our access. So we zoom around the world now with the help of an atlas and an expert.
Steve Levine. I'm a contributing editor at Foreign Policy, and I'm an adjunct professor of energy security at Georgetown's School of Foreign Service.
First stop, the Middle East.
This is the epicenter of oil production in the world now and going forward for, say, five decades. But the only place where a foreign oil company can drill for oil is Libya.
Okay, was Libya, until protests and war broke out. That means now, all Middle Eastern oil is controlled by governments, many facing political unrest, including
Saudi Arabia promised to produce an extra 200,000 barrels a day. The highest production.
Yes, the government of Saudi Arabia. State control of oil matters because Riyadh is expected eventually to tighten the spigot, pump less. Not for economic reasons, but to save it for future generations of Saudis.
If you're Saudi Arabia, you probably want to stay in the game for the long run.
Steve Kopitz is with energy consultancy Douglas Westwood.
So there's an incentive to be measured about how they use those resources. At some point, they're going to say, that's as much as we can do.
With the recent protests, the Saudi government has actually siphoned oil money away for handouts and subsidies to the people. Amy Myers Jaffe studies oil markets at Rice University.
That's money they won't be spending expanding their oil fields, and that means less oil for other countries like the United States and Europe down the road.
An even bigger producer than Saudi Arabia is Russia. So Steve Levine and I go there, or flip there.
When the Soviet Union collapsed 20 years ago, the oil-consuming countries of the world looked at this place rubbing their hands together with glee.
Or so we thought. The problem? Moscow. Levine's case study is Chevron. It cut a deal with Russia to pipe more than 1 million barrels a day from the Caspian Sea in 1993.
Till this day, Russia has put a continuous stranglehold on those exports. It's almost 20 years.
And here's the thing. Even if Chevron jumps through one more bureaucratic hoop, who knows if it'll work in Russia?
You don't know whether it's the last hoop, and the number of the hoops and the character of the hoops change with the price of oil.
And the political angst goes from there. Hugo Chavez's Venezuela. Dow Jones reporter Angel Gonzalez doesn't even know how much Caracas has.
The government says one thing, OPEC says another thing, and the U.S. Energy Information Administration says a different thing. Nobody knows what to believe either.
Africa, Steve Levine.
Can one say that Uganda is going to be a settled place? One can't say that. Somalia?
Nigeria?
It can't get its politics right in the Niger Delta.
By one estimate, 75% of the world's oil is politically uncertain. And that includes the it country of the moment, Brazil, and its vast offshore fields controlled by state-owned Petrobras. The attitude in Brazil?
We have these big oil fields. We're a serious player. When you say BRIC countries, incidentally, we're the B. And so Petrobras has made Brazil pretty much off limits.
Meaning oil there may also not flow as quickly as we'd like. Meantime, global demand is hustling to catch up with supply. And when it does, here's what John Hess, chairman and CEO of Hess Oil, sees coming. He spoke at an industry conference.
Prices will skyrocket, with the likely outcome of bringing the world's economy to its knees. The $140 per barrel oil price of 3 years ago was not an aberration. It was a warning.
When will that come? Some predict next year. Others think 2020 or beyond, so there's time to plan ahead. Either way, the geopolitics of oil, much more than the actual supply of oil, will hasten the day of reckoning. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, protecting online privacy by removing your personal data from the internet and stopping unwanted mail. Reputation.com. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time, on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which you get perhaps more detail on the debt ceiling than you'd really care for, but which will stand you in good stead as you try to digest all the debt stories that will be no doubt coming your way in the next month or two. We were, as of last Friday, $76 billion underneath the congressionally authorized debt ceiling. $76 billion on a $14.3 billion ceiling. A tidy sum, but governmental pocket change, if you will. Anyway, that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Tuesday. Today, the Dow rebounded 65 points, about 0.5%. The NASDAQ up 9 points, 1/3%. The S&P 500 gained 7 points, nearly 0.6%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Bead, and that is where you can turn for the latest and earliest in business and economic news in the morning. Coming up next time, back here a year to the day since the BP oil spill.
People didn't want Louisiana crabs. They were scared to eat them. We lost a lot of good markets.
Life afterward in two very different parts of Louisiana. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.